duck, duck, goose!
Hi, this is Dan Nexon. This podcast is actually a recording of a panel that was held last weekend in Baltimore, Maryland, at the International Studies Association Northeast Annual Convention. The panel was on speculative fiction and pedagogy, and it featured myself, Patrick Jackson, Henry Farrell, and Jennifer Lobosch. Hope you enjoy it.
Yeah.
Is it available now?
Yeah, it's available in the U.S.
The last I checked, it wasn't.
Which was incredible. 2 glowing reviews in the New York Times review of both. So I think hopefully it's had an impact.
That was just like a skull's tour de force. His review of that for his words.
Quick huddle.
Yeah.
So 1, 2, 3, 4.
Yep.
Sounds fine.
That work?
Yeah.
You know, do the standard kind of say a few provocative-y things and we'll throw it open.
Yeah.
Are you chairing, Dan?
I don't know.
Who's chairing this panel?
I thought it was Dan.
I'm chairing?
I thought it was Dan originally.
Are you chairing?
I emailed them, but I actually think it's you.
Oh, am I chairing this?
Yeah.
Oh.
Or we could co-chair.
We could.
We could.
Would people
not
be able to
have
tell
a chair?
Difference? I don't know.
I could just stand.
We could just stand here. It says that I'm chairing.
Okay.
Wow.
Well, if it says you're chairing, then you're chairing.
I am apparently chairing. That's fascinating. I didn't know these things. But here we go. All right, start this sucker off here. You want to start yours?
I've already started.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
So the pre-show banter is actually being captured.
Of course.
Fascinating.
That's great.
Okay, cool. Well, I'm Patrick Jackson from American University, and apparently, according to my name tag, I'm also the president of the ISA Northeast. So welcome, and I'm glad everybody's here for the conference, despite the nasty weather at the beginning of the week. I'm glad we're actually still able to do this, and particularly glad that with ISA Northeast, we have the sort of space where it is perfectly acceptable to have not just one panel on popular culture and international relations, but what are we up to now, Sam? We have 3 in this conference, or 2?
At least three,
right? So there's okay. So there's something very interesting about the fact that this has now become a kind of legitimate topic of conversation in all kinds of ways. As we think about popular culture as a vehicle for theorizing about international relations, we think of popular culture as data for thinking about international relations. In this panel in particular, we're going to think about popular culture and the teaching of international relations. So this is a panel much more focused in particular on the question of pedagogy. How would one utilize works of science fiction in an IR classroom, however one defines both works of science fiction and an IR classroom, and so we'll probably have some discussion around those things. The 4 of us here, we have 4 people who've been thinking an awful lot about how one would do this, 3 of us who have been thinking an awful lot about it from the perspective of being in the trenches and doing it, and our first speaker, Henry Farrell, from the perspective of not yet having done it, but having a clear idea of what he would like to do if he gets a chance to teach a sci-fi and IR class. So we're going to go in that order. It's going to be Henry Farrell from George Washington first, followed by Dan Nexon from Georgetown, followed by Jennifer Lobosch from the University of Delaware, and then me, as I said, from American. We'll say a few things, hopefully somewhat provocative, and then we will throw it open for some discussion because, you know, it's a conference and that's just how we roll. So, with that said, Henry, take it away.
Okay, well, I guess as Patrick said at the beginning right there, I haven't actually taught an IR course in a science fiction, so really I'm going to talk about pedagogy in the broadest sense. And here, in a certain sense, I'm particularly interested in the kind of ways in which the ideas that science fiction writers have intersect with the ideas that IR scholars have, and what this might be used for if you were not to think of this in the direct pedagogical sense of teaching a class, but instead trying to expose, for example, graduate students to ideas which might hopefully blow their minds a little bit. Because I think this is really where the value of science fiction, the value of science fiction is that it's fun, but the value from a pedagogical sense, I think, really has a lot to do with unsettling the basic core ideas, the received wisdom, many of the kinds of tropes which we train our graduate students in, and getting them to realize that these tropes, these ways of seeing the world, are contingent, are dependent upon a particular historical phase, a set of assumptions about the ways in which the international system works, states work, borders work, and so on, and getting them to realize that these sort of assumptions might be relaxed under certain circumstances, and that this can be a really genuinely useful way to think about the world. Now, this in part may reflect my own background. I'm kind of a weird person to be teaching international relations. I never took a PhD level international relations course in my life. I'm now teaching the core IR theory sequence in George Washington University, basically on the grounds of what I have picked up here and there over the years. And this means that if I come to this as a foreigner myself, in other words, the ideas of international relations, I haven't absorbed and internalized in the same way that I think most or many graduate students have. I treat them as being very interesting, very useful, but for me, international relations is and always will be a second language. And I think that there are weaknesses to this, but there are also strengths to this. And one of the ways in which you can kind of capitalize some of these strengths without necessarily having the problems associated with having international relations as a second language is to expose students to ways of thinking about the world in which these assumptions are not taken for granted, and hence allowing them to be more playful in a certain sense with ideas than they would be otherwise. And here, this is really, I think, going back to the 18th century German writer Novalis, really what you want to do is to make the strange familiar and to make the familiar seem strange. And practically, I think this is what science fiction can do as a kind of tool of inquiry. And here you can think about Ken MacLeod, for example, has this great quote that the trade secret of science fiction is history. And so really what I think he's referring to here is the basic idea that if you're a science fiction writer, what you want to do, you want to think about the ways in which individual character and sets of circumstances intersect in interesting ways. You want to look at different societies, how different societies worked. You want to shake up your ideas of how the present actually works in order to come up with some idea of what the future might look like. And hence, in a certain sense, you use history as a kind of comparative method to open up the set of the universe of cases that you think is relevant to understanding how the world works. And this marks, I think, a development in science fiction away from the, and here, like all potted histories of science fiction, I'm leaving out as much as I'm including, but if you could come up with a history of science fiction as being, sort of starting with the Hugo Gernsback stuff, the astounding, the John W. Campbell ideas, the cold equations, which are really kind of thinking about science fiction as a form of engineering as fiction, and then this stuff gets challenged radically in the 1960s. I think that more than the New Wave stuff, the anthropological turn that Ursula Le Guin and people like her recognize is important. You have people starting to think, okay, what about real societies? And now I think you've got a kind of a synthesis where even hard science fiction writers, so people who are doing the hard sort of space opera stuff, Paul Macaulay, people, Alistair Reynolds, people like that, they really have imbibed the idea that not only do you look at technology, not only do you look at the physical circumstances, but you look at the ways in which these intersect with societal change in order to try and come up with interesting ideas about how new societies would work. And this helps, I think, international relations in relaxing the kinds of standards assumptions that we have, in opening up the imagination, but in doing so in a relatively controlled fashion. Now, this obviously is not to say that science fiction is a form of prognostication. It emphatically is not, but what it does is it expands your mental universe by helping you to think, okay, if this happens, if that changes, if society, you know, if technology changes or if society changes in that way, what are the possible repercussions? What are the knock-on effects? And by thinking about the world from that angle, you can come back to the world that we actually inhabit from a different angle, one in which the kinds of things that we take for granted are not really necessarily to be taken for granted at all. And three science fiction works, which I'm very briefly going to run through, which I think do this in nice ways. First is Charlie Strauss's Halting State. I don't know how many of you people have read it. It's a really fun book. On the one hand, it takes on some of the aspects of the technological thriller in the way that it presents its subject matter. Clearly, he's trying to have fun and to attract people, including non-traditional science fiction authors, to read this stuff. He's modeling himself quite deliberately on a massively popular British writer, Christopher Brookmeyer. He's not a science fiction writer, and he's trying to appeal to the Brookmeyer audience. But he's also welding that to a pretty extraordinary set of imaginary pyrotechnics about what a world might look like 10 or 15 years from now, in which some of the trends that we see have developed to the stage where they really are beginning to shift society. I think the fundamental question that Halting State and its sequel, the third book which is yet to be written, is going to be his take on international relations and diplomacy, so of course that's going to be a lot of fun. But the first two books, I think the real question they ask is, what is going to happen in a world where decentralized, networked action really becomes common, where it becomes ever more difficult to associate actions, you know, sort of consequences with actions and intentions? How do we exist in that kind of world? What kind of consequences is this world going to have? What kinds of social order might emerge instead of the happy fictions that we tell ourselves about how it is that, you know, so we have states, we have rules, we have institutions, and we have individuals who react in relatively predictable ways to those institutions. And he's got a really nice setup where he talks about, you know, so a world in which you see states, you know, sort of being attracted to this world, attracted to the possibilities of using decentralized networks to achieve their own objectives, but these decentralized networks then begin to take on a life of their own, and it becomes ever more apparent over the novel that the grown-ups, the people who are supposed to be in charge, aren't in charge, perhaps never have been in charge, and just have no more idea than the rest of us about how to deal with this new, much more complicated world that's emerging. I think this is a fun book. I think it's also a book which is very relevant to contemporary debates. Anne-Marie Slaughter, for example, is, or at least before she wrote her famous Atlantic article, was supposed to be writing a book which was about the ways in which the United States could take advantage of networks in order to achieve its foreign policy aims. I think Charlie Strauss provides a fictionalized version of some of the counter-arguments against that, some of the arguments that network theorists, people who do the statistical topology of large-scale networks like Duncan Watts, some of the arguments that they have about the fundamentally stochastic nature of action on these networks, how it's impossible to predict what's going to happen, suggesting that the kind of the Anne-Marie Slaughter approach is really not going to tell us very much. Second example is a very different example. It's China Miéville's novel, The City and the City. Again, this is a really interesting, quite fundamentally interesting book. And China, interestingly enough, is he's one of us in a sense. He did his PhD in international relations at LSE. He's a Fred Halliday product. He has written a very interesting book on international law from a Marxist perspective. And on the one hand, he is clearly not writing works of international relations theory. On the other hand, he knows enough that he can play with the ideas in some very interesting ways. What The City and the City, I think, forces us to re-examine is the nature of states, the nature of borders. It's a very simple idea, a very simple conceit, which he works out extremely logically. And the idea is you've got a city, it's an imaginary city, which is a little like Budapest, which is composed of two cities, Buda and Pest, on either sides of the river. But for China, what he does is he comes up with a city in which the two cities are intermingled with each other, so that one house on a street on on a street might belong to one city, the next house on the street might belong to its neighbor, and these are two fundamentally different cities with different inhabitants who agree tacitly not to see each other except to the very minimal extent necessary, not to bump each other into the street, pretending that the other city doesn't exist in its day-to-day interactions, and these complicated sets of processes through which one can pass through from one city into the other. And, you know, he works this out with a great deal of aplomb, a great deal of intellectual flair. But really what this pushes us to recognize is the ways in which borders, forms of diplomatic recognition and protocol, that these all rest upon social conventions, which in a fundamental sense are arbitrary. That if we thought about the world in a different way, this would have dramatically different consequences for the ways in which we organize our lives. By portraying this deliberately artificial city based upon a set of rules which can never actually be lived up to fully by the inhabitants of the two cities in question, he really forces us to think about the ways in which our lives more generally, our politics, are constructed by these protocols, these rules, these unstated assumptions about what you recognize, what you don't, which problems you deal with, which problems you do not, and forces us to recognize that these are entirely as arbitrary as the fantasticated city that he sets up. Final novel that I'm going to talk about, which I think is useful here, is not, in some senses, it's not a science fiction novel at all, in that there isn't even the hint of anything, anything which is substantially science fictional, no new technologies. This is a historical novel. This is Francis Spufford's novel Red Plenty, which is about the socialist calculation debate, really about the efforts of the Soviet Union in the 1960s and the 1970s to try to come up with some sort of a means through planning to simulate the benefits of the free market in producing goods, and in particular in producing plenty, welfare, happiness, you know, sort of sausages and good things for people at the table, and how this experiment worked. Now, what's interesting about this is that it's a historical novel, it's a mosaic novel, Vasily Grossman or other people like that, you know, sort of portraying this this process from a variety of different viewpoints. But it's a novel which is, on the one hand, historical in subject matter, on the other hand, quite explicitly written from a science fictional perspective. If you read the multitudinous footnotes and introductory text and so on, he makes it clear that he's drawing upon people like Ian Banks and their culture novels. He's trying to think about the world. Kim Stanley Robinson is, I think, more than anybody else, perhaps, an influence for him. And he's trying to think about the world in the ways in which these people think. And what this does, I think, is it imbues what should be a straightforward historical story of failure with a sense of possibility. You don't actually know, in the sense that you do in a traditional historical novel, that this stuff is going to fail. I ran a seminar on it. I do a lot of work on blogs on novels by Mieville, basically getting bunches of people together to try and talk about novels and then getting authors to respond. And when we ran a seminar on this, we had two people, one a science fiction writer and fantasy writer, Felix Gilman, another a blogger, John Halbo, both of whom had the same reaction, that they thought throughout the novel that suddenly, somehow, the Soviet cybernetic calculation stuff was going to work, that we were going to get trots in space, we were going to get some kind of, you know, sort of massive calculating machines being invented, and the world going off on an alternative path of history, which it, of course, never did. That, in fact, doesn't happen in the novel. But because he's writing it as a science fiction novel, it's imbued with this sense of possibility throughout. You're never quite sure that it's going to stick to the historical course. And this also helps, I think, if you think about the city and the city, Mieville's novel, as making the familiar strange, this is a novel about making the strange familiar. Because what it does is it takes this system, which everybody knew didn't work, everybody knew in a sense couldn't work, and allows you to look at it from the perspective of the people who were actually inside it at the time, who didn't know that it wasn't going to work necessarily at the beginning, and gives a sense of possibility, in a certain sense recaptures history, not as a process of what happened, what inevitably happened, and what was always going to happen, but as it was lived by the people at the time, as something that could have gone in a variety of different directions. And this, more generally, I think, is the advantage of science fiction for international relations. It causes us to think, to try and break out of some of the concepts that we have, that we structure the world with, to think about the world in different kinds of ways, to see how these concepts are contingent, are themselves social protocols of a certain kind of sense, to come at the world with a different set of protocols, and to see how the world could be different in important ways than the world that we have at the moment. Thanks.
All right, well, you're going to hear some significant overlap from me, and I will try to minimize that. I'm about to teach the third iteration of a course I call Interstellar Relations, although that's somewhat misleading because I think less than half of what I actually assign is space opera, let alone interstellar space opera. The course, I should say, is heavily modeled on Patrick's social science fiction course, although I do break with it both in some content and some readings, although I have found that oftentimes when I break with it, I would have been better just following Patrick's plan. One thing I think is sort of interesting as a way to segue into what I have to say is to note that just this morning I received an email from Georgetown bureaucracy saying that I'm being offered the opportunity to make this course a Doyle seminar. And the basis of a Doyle seminar is that I have to ensure that the course content addresses issues and debates about national, social, cultural, religious, moral, and other forms of diversity and difference, and helps equip students with ways of understanding different perspectives and developing a tolerant global perspective. And I think this focus on difference and diversity fits rather well into the framework of a lot of what you wind up contemplating in a speculative fiction or a science fiction and fantasy course. The takeaway of my talk, of my presentation, is rather straightforward. It's that if you want to teach a course like this, you should do it however you want to do it, but if you're going to listen to me at all, you will treat more broadly pop culture artifacts, but in this case science fiction and fantasy, less as a medium and more as the message itself. Right, that the books that you read, the articles that you give, the films that you make your students watch, should themselves be important political documents, or political science, political theory, political philosophy documents. Right. So the other here, what I'm saying you should not be doing, is I think one of the dominant trends for dealing with science fiction and popular culture and fantasy in the field right now, which is to use a fantastical setting as a way of teaching international relations, understood as the body of work that you would assign in IR 101, right? This is, and there's a lot of really good stuff that does this, right? There's Patrick James and his co-authors' book on the international relations of Middle Earth, teaching IR through Tolkien. There's the most famous example of this, which has really kind of kicked off the wave, which is Dan Dresner's Zombies, International Politics book, right? Now these all are basically designed to say, I'm going to teach you about IR by taking a fantastical setting. And the wager here is that students don't know any history, so it's better to get them on pop culture where they know something about. The wager here is that students will find it too difficult or hard to understand the theories unless they're presented in a candy-coated or sugar-coated manner. And that's fine. I mean, in our experiences are all our own experience, but what I will say is that I think it's pretty easy to teach IR 101, right? It's pretty easy to communicate history that students need to know in order to teach IR 101. And I don't really see the value added of explaining realism by talking about Aragorn, right? Or realism by talking about how zombies interact. That's fine, right? But I think it sells short the possibilities of teaching speculative fiction in a political science or social science setting. So don't treat popular culture artifacts, don't treat science fiction as a medium for communicating a pre-distilled body of knowledge associated with the field. Treat them as the message themselves. So when I talk about what I do in my classes or how I think about my classes, I usually start with some key concepts, and in fact I assign an essay that lays this out the first week of class. And this is very similar to, I think, the train you're going to hear from all of us, right? So I did this book, or I edited a volume that Patrick was actually in a while ago with Ivor Neumann called Harry Potter and International Relations. And this came out of a panel on Harry Potter, and particularly the intro chapter came out of a sort of framework I sketched out to discuss on that panel. And I think there are limitations to the framework, but by and large I think it's a useful way for thinking about how you might, the different kind of angles of which science fiction or fantasy or anything else that's popular culture intersects with IR, right? So we identified four basic ways of thinking about pop culture, and I'll just use science fiction, right? So you can talk about science fiction and politics, right? You can talk about how science fiction influences quote-unquote real-world politics, or how real-world politics influences quote-unquote science fiction. And this, probably the most famous example of this in science fiction is the work on how Star Trek influenced the space program, right? Or there's work on how Soviet culture, Soviet politics influenced the development of a specifically Soviet science fiction genre, right? There's even some hints of potential work on the political economy of science fiction after the Second World War and the way in which American dominance in Western Europe may have influenced how science fiction developed there, right? So here we're talking about science fiction as a kind of independent or dependent variable in the way that we think about it in mainstream political science. I don't do any of this in my course, but I offer my students the opportunity to write papers on these types of topics, right, if they're thinking about what their research is going to look like. The second we talked about, which is a lot of where I actually spend my time in the course, is popular culture as, we called it as a mirror, but this is really kind of what I call textual readings of science fiction, right? Reading the science fiction texts as political texts, right? And this is very similar, I think, to what you've heard from Henry, and I think you're going to hear mostly about from the other members of the panel, which is, you know, you're reading, if you pick up Halting State, you ask, what does this have to say about issues of importance in political science, political theory, political philosophy, right? Or you're picking up Red Plenty, right? How does this help us to think of, what does it have to say about a particular moment of politics, right? So in that sense, when I teach, say, Down Below Station, which is a classic science fiction novel by C.J. Cherry, which is modeled loosely on the kind of East India Company in space, and thinks about kind of the effects on society of having colonies that really were very far away and hard to get to from Earth. You know, I teach this course, I teach that book not, you know, not as, you know, as essentially a statement about how empires work, how state formation works, but in space, right? So it's equivalent to reading, Doyle's book on empire. Right, we're going to read this to get away with some interesting theory about something that's relevant to the course, or relevant to the course as I've defined it. The third way we talked about it was popular culture or science fiction as data, and this is using science fiction largely as sort of ethnographic data points. Right, and we actually do some of that in the course, right, to think about, okay, how does this particular future or past imaginary written at a particular moment, what does it say about that particular moment? So in the first iteration of the course, I had a kind of a theme running through, which was comparative apocalypse. So the first book we read was actually a series of three novellas collected together, A Canticle for Leibowitz, which is really kind of the archetypal nuclear war sends us back to the Middle Ages, and we develop forward from there till we have another nuclear war kind of story that marks the 1950s. Right? So you read this apocalypse, but you're also reading in Watchmen, right, which is another version of the nuclear apocalypse scenario, but now centered on the 80s. Right? Then you move forward, and I assign, which is a book I still teach, The Hunger Games, right, which is a future imaginary of post-apocalyptic environment, but one where we don't, a whole lot of bad stuff happens and we don't really know what it is, and here's what the post-apocalyptic scenario looks like. And I also assigned a book whose name I am blanking on. It's Wilson's mm-hmm. book about Neo-Roman Empire in America.
Julian Comstock,
right, which is a very different kind of future imaginary of what a post-apocalyptic, in this case, post-peak oil, resource depletion, environmental change scenario would go with. And that was really kind of interesting. We could talk about what would this mean. Or in the current iteration of the course, one of the first things they do the weekend the course starts is I have them watch this horrifically unsubtle Star Trek The Next Generation episode, which is sort of the gay rights episode, right, where Riker falls in love with somebody from an androgynous culture, right? And that's helpful for them because it helps them to think about, okay, there can be political messages in science fiction because it's bloody obvious. There's some neat play with it because you can get to different layers of reading. You know, it starts, you know, is this really a gay rights thing or is it kind of anti-cultural feminism? What's going on here? But moreover, because for a lot of these students, the idea that you would do a gay rights episode where you didn't talk about gayness is really weird, right? This is not their universe. So we can use this opportunity to say, well, what does it say about the early 90s and the late 80s that if you wanted to be the most progressive show on television and you were doing your gay rights episode, that it wouldn't be about gay people? Right? So in a sense, you can start to think, and this is a way for them to encounter history in different moments through, as I said, the kind of future imaginary, right? The third dimension that we looked at was popular culture as constitutive, or science fiction is actually constituting our understanding of the world. Some of this comes up in the class. In the class, we read Snow Crash, for example, and they're stunned to learn that this is where Avatar comes from, right? The idea of an avatar in a virtual world. And they say, but this is just like Second Life. And you say, yes, what is the copyright date on this book? Right? You know, and then we can start thinking about to what degree do our understanding of phenomena that we experience now, are they constituted by future imaginary accounts of them in the past? Right? And what kinds of conditions of possibility does that open up? So I do keep these four frameworks alive, but really, as should be clear from what I said at the outset, I'm really focusing on the kind of textual reading of both visual media and reading media, right? So reading in the broad sense. Now, in terms of the other key concepts that I think are important to understand, this is terrain Henry's already talked about, which is I think that one of the great reasons why we turn to speculative fiction is this notion that's almost kind of cliche in the literature of speculative fiction's role as a form of cognitive estrangement. Right, which is the sort of jargon term for exactly what Henry talked about, which is the idea that science fiction presents us a representation which estranges, is one which allows us to recognize its subject, at the same time make it seem unfamiliar. Right, this denaturalization role that speculative fiction plays. Right, and again, the sort of hammer over the head version of this, right, is we're going to talk about gay rights, but we're going to do it by talking about androgyny. Right, this can get much more complex in the way that Henry's described it with some specific artifacts that he thinks about teaching, right? So we can actually think about talking about empire, but not in the context of British imperial racism, but in the context of a starfaring empire, right? Or we can think about talking about collectivism, but not as collectivism is what the evil Soviets do, but maybe collectivism is a kind of ambiguous utopia, right? The way that Ursula Le Guin talks about it in The Dispossessed, right? Maybe we can talk about genocide and indigenous peoples, but instead of talking about what happened in North America or what happened in Australia, we will read Gene Wolfe's rumination on genocide identity and colonialism and post-coloniality. And students don't have the same kind of political capital invested in the discussion. And this is why I think speculative fiction for undergraduates is this wonderful eye-opening experience. Not only does it denaturalize and decontextualize, it allows them to check a lot of their assumptions at the door. And there's no better moment teaching a course when you have students who, say, are very left-wing, but they're reading Starship Troopers, and they think, well, maybe the franchise should only be given to the military guardians. And, oh, wait, come. When I read Plato on this, I thought this, but now maybe I should think about it differently. Right? And so that's really what we're up to. And again, you know, speculative fiction achieves this sort of cognitive estrangement through, again, another kind of jargon term that's a little hoary, the introduction of the what's called the nova or the novum, right? These unusual elements that are designed to disjoint readers. Oftentimes these are neologisms. I was just talking to Alistair Reynolds, or I just put up a podcast study with him where he talks about his specific neologisms that he develops to disrupt people's understandings of where they are, signal that you're in science fiction in his really fantastic Blue Remembered Earth, which I don't teach, but I may someday in the future. And these are also useful because they mirror this process that we have in international relations and social science of counterfactuals. Right? These play the role of the let's make the alteration and then think about how society life would be like, right, if that alteration came into being. And here I want to note that most of what we do in social science is, in fact, practical speculative fiction, right? Most of what we do is we think through counterfactual relationships, and we practice speculative fiction either retrospectively in explaining the future or prospectively in using the history to make predictive claims. And here I just want to mention, and I'm sure I'm going on too long, so I will try to brush things up a bit, that one of the interesting things, if you go to Amazon and you look at the top political science books, right, what they call political science or national affairs books, they're books like, you know, When China Inherits the World, right, or The Future Without the West, or The Post-American World, right, and these are very explicitly what our students, you know, at Georgetown, like AU, where students actually go out and read this stuff on their own because they're just like that. This is, you know, what they read. This is their primary kind of encounter with international relations outside the classroom, right? And I would say that this is, in fact, just kind of mediocre and narratively uninteresting science fiction, right? Because it's speculating about the future imaginary, and therefore it's also interesting for a zeitgeist perspective. By engaging in the kinds of reasoning that's actually very familiar and very made explicit and debated about within speculative fiction, but again, without some pre-commitments we have within social science. And indeed, one of the arguments that I've been working on with one of my grad students, Paul Musgrave, is the idea that maybe we need to do more speculative fiction in international relations, right? That we need to be thinking about what he calls exotic or strange politics. What does the world look like if parametric assumptions start to shift? Right, and what kinds of background variables and parametric variables, and particularly nonlinear effects variables, might be in our existing models that we might want to rethink from a kind of speculative fiction edge. If you want to think about, okay, what does global warming really mean? Right, what does it really mean if we enter a world in which technological change slows and growth change slows, or we in fact continue to have the global convergence, where the fundamental factor of the last 100 years, which is the radical split between the developed and the developing world, goes away? Right, does that in fact not amount to simply a linear change in politics? Does that amount to a new kind of reality of the type that, in speculative fiction, you're much more open to and used to imagining? So I'm not going to talk so much about the course architecture because I can't throw up all the books I teach. I do teach Halting State, which I think works masterfully for the reasons that have just been suggested. Also because one thing that Henry didn't mention is that it's written entirely in the second person, which is very difficult for the students, but also gets them to think about kind of the broad notion of games, right, and gaming, right, because second person, as Charlie Strauss says, is the idiom of gaming, the voice of gaming, right? You open the door, you have been eaten by a, what's the Zork?
Gru.
Yeah, you've been eaten by a Gru, right? But by and large, I would say two things about the course architecture the way I do it. The first is lots of work, lots of work, lots of work, right? I make them work their asses off. Right, they read big, thick books a week. They read secondary social science literature. Sometimes, if they don't have a science fiction book, it's because they're reading Todorov or they're reading Schmidt. Right, so difficult stuff. A typical week would be: here's some Star Trek Troopers, here's some Plato, and by the way, you're also watching. You know, you're responsible for watching 2 hours of Battlestar Galactica that week. Right, and part of the reason I can do this is because they're so into it and it's narrative and they're excited to be here. I can make them work their asses off, and I always like making people work hard. But also because, in a sense, it's a kind of game to justify what we're doing, to say this is serious stuff, right? You are not going to, you know, read a couple chapters and come in and talk about it. You're going to be thinking about all these things at the same time and drawing connections between them. So make it lots of work. It also helps to justify it with the powers that be, right? And particularly when your students say, I worked harder than I've ever worked for this course, but I got more out of it than any other course I've ever taken, you can take that to the bank when people are questioning why you're teaching science fiction in a political science context. The second is that the way that I teach the course is to weave themes across books. So there's a lot of kind of one set of themes blur into another. So one of the units that I've been doing the last couple times is a games unit, right? But that games unit, you know, it's not a unit, right? It goes across a whole bunch of books as we move in and out of themes. So Hunger Games, Player Games, Ender's Game, Halting State, which has a games element, right? And we think a little bit about politics as a game and some of the explicit things that are said, but we also think about the act of observation and interpolation into subjectivity, all these sorts of things, right? The idea is that these things bleed across one another so that any text should serve multiple purposes, bridging themes from one text or one visual media to another text or visual media, right? And I think that works really well in these kinds of books because if you choose the material, it's really rich and has lots of things going on. You're not going to be able to talk about those things at the moment, but you might be able to talk about them the next week when you're reading somebody else's take on that theme and you focus on that. The last thing I will say, besides lots of work and bleeding things together in course architecture, is if you're going to do these courses, this is a rule that we should be using for all of our seminars, but we don't because we feel obligated to do things. But in this course, you have the freedom to, and you really should, teach stuff you love and you really like and you find really interesting. Because that way your students will pick up on your enthusiasm and all that stuff, but you already know it and know all the cool stuff in it. Or you can revisit it again when your students say new things about it and you love it enough that it's interesting to have your students say something that you never thought of, right? But not only do you have the opportunity to and should you teach works that you love, you should also remind your students that they don't have to like it. Right? This is not an issue of enjoyment. My students do not particularly like Down Below Station. They find it has too many perspectives in it. They don't identify with the characters. Well, that's nice, and we can talk a little bit about that, but so what? They find Gene Wolfe excruciatingly difficult. The Fifth Head of Cerberus is an extremely difficult book. That's fine, because they're in a college course room, and stuff they're going to is sometimes going to be excruciatingly difficult. Right? But at least it's fiction, right, and not Heidegger. So they don't have any excuse to complain about it, right?
That's for sure. It's a well-defined distinction.
And those are sort of my rules of thumb, right, for doing it, and I will stop there.
Awesome. All right, pass that down so we can get the next part. Dr. Lovesh.
All right, so I will give attempt to give a very small slice of my thoughts. I sign on to most everything that Dan and Henry said, and would love to talk about all of those things, but I'm going to confine myself to a single topic, more or less, and begin by pointing out that we have a room of, just a second ago, we had, I think, 18 people in here, and 4 women. And it's funny, because when I'm at Big ISA, many of my panels are sponsored by FTGS, the Feminist Theory and Gender Studies something or another section, and the audience is primarily, if not exclusively, female. Believe it or not, that's not the case for the rest of the ISA panels in other sections that I attend. I mention this because counting women is obviously a very limited way, I say obviously, a very limited way of doing gender in IR or feminism in IR. But in many instances, it's still an important thing to do. It's still an important point to start out with. And I'll return to that thought in a minute. So the course that I'm halfway through right now is my first iteration of social science fiction, stolen wholesale from Patrick, of course, although it's not a complete stealing, because the first time he developed this course was when I was an undergrad, and I remember adding a couple of books to the syllabus myself. So there's a clear debt there, at any rate. I'm teaching the class as alien encounters, or encounters with the other or others, and we're alternating eight or so novels with four or five social science pieces. So not explicitly IR necessarily, but they're reading bits of Stuart Hall, which we start out with. They're reading some Clifford Geertz. They're reading Naeem and Ayatollah, a handful of other folks, Garrison State, and so forth. And I'm teaching this as a freshman honors colloquium at the University of Delaware, which means a couple of things. First, it's all first semester freshman honor students, which if there's a description of my favorite kind of student ever, that's probably it. They're the best. They're puppies and just so excited and with it and willing to work and just a really refreshing group, really rewarding group to teach. The honors colloquia are required for all honors freshmen in their first semester and are writing intensive, and so I have the support of a couple of writing fellows and so forth. They're supposed to be interdisciplinary, and so I'm not supposed to assume any specific subject area background from my students or interest in particular. And as it happens, when I was logging onto our course management system prior to the semester and I looked at who my students were and essentially who my students were, I noticed virtually all of them were majoring in one of the STEM fields. So I have a whole bunch of engineers, a number of people in the medical sciences, health sciences, and let's see here, one political science major and one international relations major. I also noticed that in my class of 19, gotta love the 20 student cap on this one, I had six women. And so I thought, okay, I may need to be proactive here. How am I going to handle this? Well, I started out my first class by mentioning that in the previous semester, I had taught a course on human trafficking. And as it happens, my own appointment at Delaware is 75% political science and international relations, 25% women and gender studies. And that particular course had been cross-listed. In fact, many of the people who signed up for it as a political science class did not realize it was also being offered at the same time as a women's studies class. So my class, it was primarily female, but the, I believe, four men who were in that class were occasionally very surprised to find themselves there and what we were reading. And so as the professor, I had to think, okay, how am I going to make sure that while I want everyone to some extent to have an unsettling process in the classroom, that no one feels silenced because of his or her gender. And I presented it that way to my social science fiction students, first of all, to point out that it's not just a question of women always being the minority or anyone always being in the minority, or that because it's science fiction, women are the minority. I also didn't want to make the female students feel any more singled out than they already were by my pointing out that gender exists and it might play a role in the classroom. And so I explained that gender relations in classes are something that I pay attention to, and that I wanted everybody to be aware of common things that can happen in even balanced classrooms, gender-balanced classrooms, including who's dominating the conversation, who's speaking, who always takes the secretarial role in small group works, who takes the leader role, so on and so forth. And I've made occasional small interventions in class as it's progressed, but I found that I haven't needed to make very many of them. And I found that even if my students don't necessarily articulate it as such, they must notice because their practices in class have changed, which is rewarding. In terms of what's actually more interesting to me, I think, which is looking at these science fiction and social science texts and reading them together, we use, among other things, a gender lens. And we use them on all of the books, not just the usual suspects, like we're doing Left Hand of Darkness, so of course it's appropriate there. Octavia Butler's Wild Seed, of course it's appropriate there. We also used a gender lens to look at War of the Worlds and Ender's Game and Speaker for the Dead. so on and so forth. And I think students have surprised themselves by what using that kind of lens reveals about culture, about politics, about self and other relations. In terms of what students actually take from this, I figured I'd just go straight from the horse's mouth. And so yesterday I asked him. And all of the responses I got were fairly fascinating, but four in particular stood out to me that I want to share with you insofar as I can read the handwriting. So first, the left hand of darkness taught me that gender is not a dichotomy. Speaker for the Dead taught me that gender relations is a cultural practice and that I, as a Western man, have a certain bias. Two, coming from a very conservative hometown in high school, this class has been eye-opening due to the diversity in views and experience with gender that classmates have shared. It's made the discussions that much more interesting with respect to gender and sexuality to hear from perspectives that I'm unfamiliar with, or more so, hadn't even known existed. In sci-fi, gender is used in every novel as some sort of symbolism, so it adds to the understanding of the novel by having these varied perspectives. Being around a feminist sister, I've always been aware of gender roles and stereotyping. But because she is a, quote, run up and down the streets with picket signs, quote, kind of person, I never really fully appreciated or even took seriously what she had to say. This is hilarious because I am totally a run up and down the streets with a picket sign kind of person, but not in the classroom. This class made me realize that gender is and has been for a long time a legitimate political issue. My awareness has led me to talk to my sister, discuss the issue, and open my mind to what she has to say. And finally, it became apparent to me as I read Watchmen how intensely different society expects women to be. All the main male characters in Watchmen may be described by the following: a hero, emotionally ranging from generally calm to apathetic, and understanding of the horrors of the world. Women embody the following characteristics: generally more emotional, less equipped for battle, parenthetical, the only female superhero in the book doesn't even have a gun. Sexually emotionally attached to a male character. Don't get me started on how useless and scanty Lori's superhero suit is when compared with the other heroes. Don't compare her to the naked Dr. Manhattan. He's naked because he sees no reason to be embarrassed by nudity. He's too smart for that. And so on and so forth. It's clear that men and women are portrayed very differently and unequally. Frankly, I think everyone would be better off without gender. So students are concluding a variety of things and hopefully will continue thinking on the issues, but what's been so rewarding for me teaching this class, among the many things that have been rewarding for me, is the moment when, whether it's War of the Worlds, when there's gender here, or it's the Left Hand of Darkness, you can see on their faces and hear in the discussion the moment when they realize there are other ways to think about things. And thinking about things in different ways might tell us something about the situations we find ourselves in. Again, as individuals, as members of a political community, or so forth. And I can't imagine a more useful thing to take from studying what we study.
Cool. All right. So, I'm gonna read a couple of paragraphs from the syllabus of the last time I taught this class, the social science fiction class. And I'll say just one sort of preparatory, two preparatory things about it. I wrote the first version of this syllabus when I was 12. Yes, I knew what a syllabus was when I was 12. And part of why I did so was because of things like Watchmen, which were just starting around that time. And it occurred to me, reading through some of the first issues and sort of thinking about especially particularly the fourth issue of Watchmen, in which Dr. Manhattan ends up kind of having this sort of post-quantum rumination on time, which is just absolutely brilliant stuff. I remember looking at that and going, oh, you know, actually, people who are really kind of interested in things like relativity should probably read this before they try the math, because at least then they'll get some sense of what they're doing, so that this is really kind of helpful. So, like, hey, you know, this is a useful occasion for this. So I sort of said that would be a good thing to do, and so I really wanted to do this. When I came down for my job interview at American, however many years ago that was, we were having lunch during the job interview, and they asked the standard sort of job interview question, what's the course you would love to teach? And so I, you know, stammered out the typical, oh, I really like intro classes because most people treat them as service, but wow, I think they're these great opportunities. Then it was obvious bullshit. Everybody kind of knew it was obvious bullshit. And then there were two students there at lunch, and they said, no, really. And I said, okay, I want to teach a sci-fi class. It was like you could hear a pin drop. And then the entire rest of the lunch was all about that. And we just spent time talking about what the sci-fi class would look like. It was fortunate that I had been revising this version of the syllabus since I was 12, so I could quickly kind of jot it down on a napkin. This was on the pre-iPad days, so I couldn't actually like show them a version. But we started talking about the ways in which one would kind of do this. The first time I put the course up as an honors seminar, it was vetoed by the then provost. And it was vetoed by the then provost because I was a tenure line, pre-tenured faculty member. And the then provost was afraid that it would look bad on my record, since I hadn't gone for tenure yet, if I had this course as something that I had taught. So I decided to do a quick dodge and change the title of the course and send it back up the chain again. And somehow moving from social/science/fiction to envisioning the future of world politics made it acceptable, and then the course was taught under that title. The second time I taught it, it was called Envisioning the Future of World Politics, :social science fiction. The third time I taught it, I had tenure, so it was called Social Science Fiction, which has been its name ever since. I've taught it 7-8 times, sort of as often as they let me do it. It is one of my favorite classes to teach. So I want to read you just a couple of things just from the syllabus, and I'm going to talk just generally about some of the what I think this course is for. So here's what the syllabus actually says. Social science has the explanation of society as its explicit goal. Social scientists often try to achieve this goal by studying historical situations in order to elucidate the impact of various factors on outcomes in the hope that these impacts can then be extrapolated to other cases. Authors of science fiction engage in similar strategies, although their methods are often more speculative and their conclusions often more metaphorical. Is this commonality of orientation and approach forms the impetus for the course? Is social science a form of science fiction? What, if anything, distinguishes imaginative constructions from scientific constructions? Is science fiction a form of social science? Can an engagement with works of science fiction enhance our understanding of political and social relations? These and other questions will be explored through the readings of various science fictional texts. The last several times I've taught the class, I have really focused it in on a recurrent theme. So this paragraph, which isn't in the first version of the syllabus, but is in there now. This semester's course is entirely focused on this single recurrent theme, which is the cultural politics of alien encounter, and what that tells us about the boundaries of the human. I phrase it this way to avoid the misperceptions, and I think it's a good idea when you do a class like this to sort of deal with the misperceptions right up front in the syllabus, to avoid the misperceptions that A, this is a class about the actual or potential existence of extraterrestrial life, or that B, this is a class about actual contact between humans and extraterrestrials. It is neither. Instead, our subject will be confined to the various ways in which non-terrestrial others, aliens, some of whom look suspiciously like members of our own species, have been envisioned and imagined, and how the relations between humans and these aliens have been depicted. As we shall see, the human-alien interface is a productive site for the investigation of a number of topics of social and political relevance, etc., etc. Then I have, in terms of a diffusing possible misperceptions up front, I have another paragraph that is always in the syllabus. Three important points about the class by way of a negative definition of the Enterprise. Number one, it is not a science fiction appreciation class. It is not a science fiction fan club. While I presume many of you will probably be fans of the genre, the class is not simply a forum for displaying our fanaticism to one another. Number two, it is not primarily a literature class. The artistic merits of the literary styles of individual authors and texts may figure into our discussions from time to time, but I do not expect them to be central issues of concern. And then third, and this echoes something Dan said about making sure that this is a hard class, it is not simply an excuse to read and watch science fiction for credit. If you peruse the assignments detailed below, you will discover this class demands as much, if not more, work than other seminars. Granted, you may find some of the work more enjoyable because of the subject matter, but this should not detract from the seriousness of the endeavor. And then the final paragraph by way of a discussion of the class says, do not try to outgeek the professor either. He has been attending both Star Trek and Star Wars conventions since before you were born, and he has watched more episodes of Doctor Who than you have. I think it's important to kind of establish that setting in the beginning so that students have a clear, I mean, something we should do in all of our syllabi, right, but so the students have a clear idea of what it is that they're actually getting into and what it is they're not getting into, because my experience over the years has been when I say I'm going to do the science fiction class, the students will often think, oh, cool, I can go read novels and watch Battlestar Galactica and get an A. No, this is a lot more complicated than that in terms of the stuff you're going to do. A good strategy, which I know Dan also uses, is make sure that they've got stuff like Koshmet on the syllabus so that there's things that are actually tough that they're getting through and going, wait a minute, this is supposed to be enjoyable. No, I totally agree. It's not about the enjoyability of what you're doing. But I'll say as a little bit more schematically, sort of three things that I would advise if you're ever going to teach a class like this not to do. And then I'm going to talk very quickly about what it is I think one does do in a class like this. So three things not to do. Echoing things that have already been said, please, please, please do not use sci-fi as a vehicle for communicating IR theories, i.e. read a novel and play spot the realism. Not a fun game, not particularly helpful, and if you want to spot the realism, there are better places to spot the realism or spot the liberalism or spot the whatever. Not a very fun endeavor. You know, I like Pat James and Abigail Gruen. I think they're totally wrong about some of the politics of Middle Earth, but because they have this persistent tendency to conflate Uruk-hai and other forms of orcs. But anyway, I think there's something really deeply flawed about taking a marvelous work of speculative fictional literature and shoving it into the pseudo-intellectual boxes we misleadingly call paradigms or schools. And it really does a great disservice to try to do something like that. And so please don't do that. If you're going to teach a class like this, I mean, there's other ways to do it. If you're really looking for creative ways to just communicate parts of IR theory, there's other ways of doing it. If you're going to use a work that's really rich like this, respect its richness. Second thing I would say don't do, unless you're teaching a class that is actually kind of a regional class or a class about a particular society, I would avoid doing overmuch social contextualization of the works. Because the discussion I find among, and this may be a DC bias in terms of the kinds of students that I get, at least at American, most of whom want to save the world by next Friday, possibly twice, different things that it needs to be sort of liberated from. And if you give them the option of taking a fictional text and turning it into a piece of endogenously generated data about a set of social and political relations, they will quickly go through the text and start talking about the social and political relations and leave the text far behind. So here's Watchmen, and Watchmen is sort of about the Cold War. Boom! Okay, they just want to talk about the Cold War now. They don't want to talk about Watchmen anymore. They want to go right through the text and get to other stuff because they have this sort of reality bias, right? Like somehow I want to actually go talk about it. Talking about real things. Now, the fact that when you talk about the Cold War, it's not clear that you're talking about real things is sort of not something that they will immediately go to. And I find the best way pedagogically to get them to that is sort of say, yeah, you know, there's context and there's biography and stuff, but like, let's not focus there, right? The exception to that would be if you're teaching a class that is actually about the Cold War, or you're teaching a class that is actually about, you know, Bosnian politics or whatever, and you're using novels as ways of cutting into those things. That's fine. That's not the kind of class I'm talking about here. I'm talking more about a class that's sort of specifically on science fiction and world politics or science fiction and NIR. So I'd say don't contextualize too much because the students will want to. The students will want to pull it away from the text. And part of our job is to drive them back into it so that they have to grapple with the text itself. I think that's important. There's something really, I mean, this is a slight, I don't know. The more I do any sort of IR teaching, the more frustrated I get about the fact that we just don't teach people how to do close reading anymore of anything. And so they're just not prepared. And so they go, oh, right, let me skim this real fast and see if I can extract a couple of variables and a hypothesis and a little bit of evidence. No, you can't do that. And sometimes you can do full stop by giving them a fictional text and saying, okay, so what exactly is Card's argument in Ender's Game? And they go, what do you mean, argument? No, seriously, this is a work of fiction that you're going to try to extract what the argument is from this. And but there's no argument here. He doesn't have a thesis. Well, you know, let's see. And then the first thing they'll do is they'll find characters expressing. They say, oh, no, this character, this is Card's argument. And you say, really? Really? Because that character's take on things is persistently foiled by the rest of the novel. And didn't the author write the whole novel? And isn't this an imagined situation? So what's the author actually saying by setting up a position and showing it being systematically foiled or taken apart or inadequate? They go, oh, whoa, the argument might not be in what people say. It might actually be in the whole way the thing is set up. And then, I mean, Dan made the allusion to sort of, you know, they didn't see this when they read Plato, but maybe they see it when they read Starship Troopers. It sort of goes back to, oh, wait, when I'm reading a text, I actually have to look at the text itself as an artifact, and maybe I can extract things from this. And then the really fun thing to do is sort of get them all set up to do this, and then throw a regular mainstream current US IR from journals at them. And then they go, oh, I'm going to try to use the same techniques of close reading on the following thing from International Studies Quarterly. Wait a minute. It all dissolves like water, and there's nothing there. Ah, look, you've learned something. So I think it's important that we drive people into the text and don't and sort of resist the fact that what they want to do is they want to lock it down by making the text into something that's just epiphenomenal. So I think there's an important pedagogical thing there. And then finally, and this also sort of exemplifies or picks up on something that was said before, I mean, please don't try to treat sci-fi as a set of falsifiable predictions, though that can be fun to see what people got wrong. You know, it's not the point. One can read Ursula Le Guin's marvelous introduction to The Left Hand of Darkness, the paperback edition of it, where she has a great line about how science fiction is just basically an extended way of saying, open your eyes, look. It's about the present. It's about sensitizing you to different things in the present through this sort of mechanism of speculative extrapolation. That said, let me just say very briefly sort of what I actually think one does in this class, or what I do in this in a class like this, and what I would offer to you as a possibility for this. We've talked a lot about dislocation, and I think dislocation is an incredibly important function that sci-fi can play in these kinds of contexts. Not only sci-fi, there's other ways of doing things. Whenever I am forced to teach Greek philosophy, which I haven't been for years, but when I was at Columbia teaching in the Contemporary Civilization program, when they make you start with the Greeks, I would teach the Greeks as a form of cognitive estrangement. You know, see how freaking weird Plato was compared to what we all think of as normal. See how strange this stuff is, and basically the punchline is, you know, the Greeks did not actually think like we do. That's really odd. They have these odd ways of putting things together. So there's this kind of defamiliarization that goes into it. So you don't need sci-fi to do this kind of dislocation. I think it's important to remember what level you're pitching the class at. Straight up, dislocation of assumptions is really helpful for first year undergrads. It's really helpful if you're teaching an honors seminar, right? It's really helpful if you're dealing with folks that are kind of at the developmental beginning of their college educations. Particularly, I mean, one of the comments that Jenny read, the student who's coming out of the conservative family background and the conservative hometown and such. I mean, the kid's been on campus for 6 weeks, and wow, look how far the kid has come in terms of, like, there's other stuff in the world. It's really strange. There you go. That's the first year experience right there. So for that kind of a class, I think dislocation is enough. Like, you want them to walk out going, wow, it's freaking weird and much more complicated than I thought it was. And you've sort of discharged your pedagogical responsibility by just disrupting. I don't think that that's enough for all kinds of these classes taught at all different sorts of levels. I mean, you know, as Nietzsche pointed out, right, the lion that roars and says no is just a developmental phase. Nihilism is something you get over. So you go through it to something else. And it's that something else that I think if you're teaching the class in a different kind of format, that it can be more of a vehicle for. And this was really driven home to me the last time I taught this class. Because usually when I've taught it as an honors, interdisciplinary honors seminar, so we get people from across campus. The last time I taught this class, for various institutional political reasons I'm not going to go into, it was actually taught as a class within my home unit. It was actually taught within the International Relations School, the School of International Service. And the thing that was absolutely bizarre is I had a group of, they're all majors, all people who've been sort of majoring in IR, and they come into the classroom, and we started talking on the first day about their ethics of otherness and encounter and so on and so forth, and it quickly became apparent to me there was something weird going on in the room where people were not quite understanding what I was saying. Because I would ask them about things like, what would be the morally appropriate thing to do in this sort of situation? And they would respond with all sets of practical considerations. And I would say, no, I don't mean that. I mean, what's the right thing to do in this situation? And they would come back with what's the effective, or what's the version of things to do that would promote our advantage? And I was like, wait a minute. So I kind of had to call a stop. I was like, wait a minute. Let me make sure you understand what I'm asking you. What is the correct thing to do? And after about 5 minutes of this, it finally dawned on me, and it was like, okay, it's a long class. I got to call a break now so I can kind of regroup mentally. They had absolutely no cognitive or philosophical equipment for making sense of an ethical question. These were seniors in an IR program in Washington, D.C. And for them, somehow, over the course of their education, they had come to equate what is the right thing to do with a practical, technical, strategic question about what is the most advantageous to do given certain sets of interests. They no longer had something that you might refer to as a moral imaginary. It wasn't there. And I was like, whoa, this is astonishing. How have we managed to train a group of really bright students? I mean, it's not intelligence, right? It's something about the, not even the explicit curriculum that we've given to them, but the hidden curriculum that they picked up. That since all of the classes were about these technical issues about strategy, whether one is a realist or a liberal or whatever, but they were all about the same basic, there was just no way for them to think about this question of how should you treat alien others that might or might not be in some sense human for some expanded definition of what it means to be human. And they just literally didn't know how to hear that question, let alone start answering. So what occurred to me as a result of this was that for students who are not, if not the first year seminar, straight up disruption kind of thing, that the other kind of function that a class like this can serve, if you pitch it at a different level or to students at a different kind of stage of cognitive development, is that the works of science fiction are themselves sense-making exercises, moral sense-making exercises, in which authors are trying to pick through the systematic empirical consequences of things, but usually for the purpose of having some kind of moral and ethical reflection on, or making them available for moral and ethical reflection. And it was that second dimension that they just weren't getting, because there's something about reading something that brands itself as social science, where we bring a different set of epistemic criteria to it, and we say, is it a good explanation? And we don't take the next step and say, okay, well, is it a right explanation? Is it morally appropriate to be sort of going in these directions? And so even though within the history of U.S., even U.S. political science, you have figures like Harold Laswell, who spent a lot of his career writing pieces of speculative fiction about the Garrison state and what might happen, and says right explicitly up at the front of every time he does this, this is an imaginative extrapolation for the purpose of promoting moral reflection. And if you look at all the secondary literature on the Garrison state, it's all about the Laswell hypothesis and whether or not Laswell effectively predict the coming of the Garrison state. So even within the field, we don't leave these spaces open for reflection. And so what seems to me that pedagogically, one of the best things you can do with this kind of with this sort of class, with thinking about this theory of questions of science fiction, is to say something like, how should we grapple with these questions? Right, to reinvent them as moral questions and say, okay, maybe it makes us able to grasp the world in ways that are not just explanatory. It's not just that social science can be a form of science fiction and vice versa, but that there's something else going on in the sense-making process that science fiction can kind of point the way to in ways that the language game of social science closes off. Because if we're doing social science, you have to explain. That's kind of, you know, to quote Weber slightly out of context, it's your damn duty. I mean, if you're doing social science, you're engaged in kind of explanatory exercise. That's the heart of the thing. But there's more to it when it comes to, especially undergraduate students, thinking broadly about world politics. And so, I mean, the punchline here is, if you're teaching a class like this, don't lose sight of the fact that part of what you're able to equip students with by having them think through these works of speculative fiction is precisely the set of equipment that we don't spend an awful lot of time refining in their regular social science kinds of courses. That we can use it as an opportunity to get them to kind of reflect on an aspect of their study that they haven't actually been cognizing particularly. And there are some great ways of doing this. One of my favorite is whenever we have a scientist character in any of these books, to start saying, okay, so we've got this person here, and who does this remind you of, and are there people in classes you've had where you've heard things like this? Get people to start thinking about the epistemic status of their own reflections through the novel itself, that's sort of more non-threatening if it's like politics on the planet Greblon as opposed to the Arab-Israeli conflict. You can say, okay, well, we can sort of tease the thing out of that one. But I would say don't lose sight of that moral imaginary dimension, that is key, and that is something that is not well done in other parts of traditional, even broad-based social science education. And this is a great opportunity to be able to do something like that and push people in that direction. And on that, I'm going to end and toss it open, because I'm sure there are probably some questions that people. Dr. Levine.
I just want to follow up. I mean, there's so many interesting things here. I'm just going to follow up this one because it's something I thought of much recently, and I think it's kind of a four-year-old. But I think you're right. I mean, there's this, we have a field in which senior scholars, a group of senior scholars, are now kind of gamely coming back and looking at their own sense of location and asking where it went. Right? And, you know, I think that Cats and Science for Social Speech was like that. I think that Cohen's recently written an article like this. I think there's this Milner-edited volume on the state of social science, the state of political science, right? And there's an awful lot of people kind of, and you know, Joe Nye's got a novel about a character who loses his soul and finds it, goes back to Mount Manhattan and reads the book. Couldn't possibly be Joe Nye. And, you know, and I think that's right. So, right, there's some, you know, Rabeau's got his imaginative first chapter of The Tragedy, right, about Nixon in Hell, but Hell happens to look just like Auschwitz, right? And right, I mean, there's something about, not to be sort of crudely review about it, but there's something about our field which only lets us do that if we're either very senior scholars, or if we imagine this somewhere else, writing a different genre, a different place, so when Oded Lohenheim wrote this autobiographical thing, it got criticized by a lot of people for being coy and precious, and he's too junior for this sort of thing, and the mirror isn't distant enough, right? And yeah, I don't know, when we're training grad students, you know, in normatively inflected international theory, why should the mirror be so distant? I mean, maybe that's a way maybe reading Nye, the social scientist, against Nye, the novelist. You know, or last of all, the social scientist against last of all, the science fiction. Right. You know.
Right. Well, and I'll let the other bit, but just sort of the thing it kind of sparks for me. We don't read people in this discipline, right? I mean, not like one does in philosophy, right? One sits down and reads Adorno, One sits down and reads a book.
Yes.
Others of us don't. We sit down and read Weber, or we read Nietzsche, or whatever, right? But, like, there's something kind of silly about reading Jonah or reading Cohen, right? I mean, there's something about the interpretive equipment that we bring to bear that doesn't sort of lend itself to that particularly well. And I guess part of the, I don't know the answer to this, but I guess part of the question is, so what would the field look like if we did that more?
More because people do that, right? Because more because we've been for a long time.
Right.
You know, like he's got philosophical pretensions.
Right.
Right. So we could do that with more cacao. We could maybe do it with college.
Right. We could do, but, you know, I mean, you're starting to see it with Waltz.
Right.
You know, there's that volume now, there's that conference at the King of Thought, right? So the people are starting to be able to read Waltz better. I wonder, I mean, does that mean that the only way you can do this in IR is if they become canonical and therefore dead? And then you can read them, like, closely. I don't know. Because it's so much easier to do with an author that you just pick up something and go, oh, yeah, fictional text, cool. So then, like, you can read Ian Banks, and that just makes perfect sense. And you go, okay, cool, right? Because Banks wrote a whole bunch of novels, and they kind of play off each other. Charlie Strauss, right? You can read Charlie Strauss, and you can sort of, or Meville, and you can kind of construct something from it. I don't know. There's something different about the genre expectation, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah. I'm really glad that Patrick and Daniel brought up this issue, especially I love that phrase, the moral imaginary, because it speaks to something that is one of the more important aspects of what I hope that my students get out of the class, but it also speaks to why I love teaching this class so much and what it does for me as a teacher and how that translates into keeping on with the scholarship. In class, I've noticed that there are a couple of themes that we've tried to visit or that we've noticed emerging across all of the texts, and those themes include communication, duality, rationalism, fear, knowledge, and love. And I think both knowledge and love are the two that have surprised my students the most. And especially with the love, they're the ones I have to prod my students most to go nearer, to think about out loud. But I also think that the most significant and useful themes in what we're reading. I guess we could add religion or the divine to that list too. And as I was reflecting on that and thinking about how the course was going, it occurred to me that, oddly enough, all of my classes, whether I'm teaching grad level global governance or philosophy of science, or whether I'm teaching international organization or what have you to undergrads, those are the themes that come up in all of the classes that I teach, which I'm sure says something about the subject matter, but also says something about my interests as an IR scholar. And the extent to which those are not evident in my own work, I think speaks to some of this alienation from these questions in the field and provides a little insight to myself and, hey, maybe these are directions I ought to go, maybe even before I have tenure. And so that's one of the ways in which the class has been a learning experience for myself.
Well, sort of. So I think that the tension that Patrick is talking about here, it's a real one, but it reflects the ways that social scientists think about the world and the way that novelists think about the world. If you read a text by Cohen, as you say, you don't want to read a text by Cohen. So there's no, there. Well,
wait. I'm sorry. Can I put you here so you can say that again? Okay.
But you know, you don't want to. There's no ambiguity. The idea behind how international relations sees itself as a field is a reduction of ambiguity. So you get an argument about sort of relative gains versus absolute gains. You get people yelling at each other, and then people either they either agree to disagree or they come to something which they think is some kind of a clarification. It may or may not be a clarification. It just may be a change in the topic, but then people move on. And you, yeah, and so the idea is, the ideal that you're supposed to strive towards is a text which is perfectly transparent, where the logic, you know, sort of shines through, and where deep reading doesn't actually repay anything because shallow reading is what you're supposed to have provided. And this is very different from the way that a novelist writes. You know, so I mentioned Francis Spufford, and Spufford talks in the seminar which I organized at Crooked Timber, a blog which I contribute to, about the ways in which, you know, so he borrows extensively from social science and from, in particular, he's interested in questions of causation and counterfactuals and trying to play with how these work. But then he says, well, but you know, so I'm a novelist, I'm not a social scientist, and this means that I can use what's a negative capability, as Keats's idea of negative capability, that I can have a, you know, 20 or 30 different meanings quarreling with each other in the novel, and none of them necessarily wins out in the end. And this is what gives the novel its interest. You know, so it's a tension. It's not one single set of ideas which you're seeking to present. It's a tension between a variety of different ideas which are fighting it out with each other. And this is, you know, this is something which you do get in a more traditional vein of social science. If you read Weber, you know, so very clearly, you know, so Weber contains multitudes within himself. You can, you know, so there's a whole bunch of different Webers arguing with each other. There's the bureaucratic Weber. There's the, you know, so the, you know, so he hasn't decided. You know, so he reflects these warring ideas of what the social sciences are. This is what makes him rich. But Morgenthau, and sort of who very clearly is strongly influenced by Weber, you know, so if you read his work on sort of politics as a vocation, seems to me to be the shadow text behind that text, is similar, you know, so albeit not as interesting because I don't think Morgenthau was as smart as Weber in any fundamental sense. And there are very few people today who repay that kind of reading. The only person who really springs to mind is James Scott. If you read his work, you know, so again, you know, so Scott, first of all, he can write. He knows how to write beautifully, which is something that very few few of us do. Secondly, he's conducting an argument with himself where he doesn't fully convince himself the one way or the other. There are ambiguities, there are tensions, there are parts of the book which don't sit necessarily well with other parts of his books, and these are sources of strength rather than sources of weakness. And so, you know, he repays deep reading in a way which I think very few of us do.
Let's see, Melody.
Okay, so I'm going to throw out a challenge here. I'm speaking as a publisher. If you guys want to accomplish what you're just saying, then you yourselves in the academy have to think about what you're doing, you have to think about what your goals are and how you're doing the tenure process. So for example, the people you talked about, like reading Weber, reading Morgenthau, those are brand names, just the way Stephen King is a brand name. Ever hear of Parker Lee? Well, she is the one who wrote To Kill a Mockingbird. She wrote one novel, okay? Part of the reason that we publishers are skeptical about autoethnography is we don't think we can sell a book that's about one person's experience, okay? And what Professor Garrow was just saying about ambiguity, I send out manuscripts for review, and every single review comes back with, this argument isn't consistent. This or that isn't clear. If you want to see ambiguity, if you want to see that kind of thing, you have to be able to accept it. I've said enough.
And it's not an anonymous they that does this stuff. It's us.
No, it's sort of interesting. I mean, I have a paper that's been batted around that, you know, it's only gone to one place, but was rejected. And part of the problem we have in that paper is that we don't know some things about what happened in the case, right? And we will never know some things about what happened in the case because there are too many perspectives, too many people covering their asses, all that sort of stuff. But that's been extremely difficult for people to read it and say, you know, but how can you say this, right? You know, or aren't you admitting that you could be wrong, right? Or aren't you admitting that you are wrong? So I don't know, but I think that, I'm not sure why this is an issue of autoethnography, right? This is an issue about how you present and make arguments. And I would say that there's a difference between having a argument which is clearly articulated, which has clear implications, and then that doesn't require you to not embrace ambiguous
data, ambiguous empirics, ambiguous adjudication of arguments, right? We could go back to Weber, right? But this is an ideal type is extremely sharp by its nature, but the admission of constructing that ideal type is that it is ideal, not real. So I don't know, that's felt like a better intervention when I was thinking about it than it actually came out as being, so I'll shut up.
Well, and I know there's a couple other hands, but I just want to say, you know, a half cheer for consistency. That it's not, I don't think it's simply the case that the virtue of a literary text is that it's ambiguous, because in many ways I think a good piece of science fiction is more consistent than a lot of the stuff that we peddle as social science. Part of the reason for that is because you think reviewers of peer reviewers for social science articles are rabid about consistency. Try introducing continuity errors into Battlestar Galactica and see what happens. Right? It's amazing. The recent acquisition of Lucasfilm by Disney, right? I had to find someone to bring this up. Even though Star Wars isn't actually sci-fi, it's high fantasy in space. But the point stands. The main concern among the fan community, the Star Wars fan community, is if Disney makes Episode 7, are they going to screw up the continuity of the Expanded Universe novels? That's like the main concern. And again, peer review can be kind of nasty, but hell hath no fury like the fans scorned, right? Think about all the feedback, the work that Peter Jackson had to do to make Lord of the Rings work with the fan community. In terms of saying, no, we're going to make some changes, but we still get the spirit of the story right, and so on and so forth. So there is a way that I think social science isn't quite as consistent as we like to think that it is. I think that the virtue of the literary text, in some ways, is that it has to tease out implications that in social science we don't necessarily have to run these things out as far as they possibly can. Just a thought.
I'm concerned about the outcomes of these classes, especially when compare some with regular classes. I'm a junior scholar, and I was very criticized by the dean of my department because I was trying to offer pop culture classes during my business study regular classes for freshmen. Mm-hmm. Because he said that the other professor achieved more concrete outcomes, and by offering them pop culture and movies and Watchmen, they were more concerned on how they could extrapolate the thought instead of really applying the knowledge to other classes. Mm. How do you deal with this?
It's a very good question. Dan, you want to say something about that? Or?
Well, I mean, let's begin with the idea about how we measure learning outcomes, right? And ask yourself, is there any basis from most of what we do to measure learning outcomes of making any kind of competitive assessment about one class being more effective than another, right? Most of what we do is collect course evaluations, which are worthless, right, as measures of learning outcomes, right? Most of what we do is, so I just don't know, right, what the basis of even that estimation would be, right? So the whole question strikes me as messed up, right? I would ask, well, what is your evidence that this person has good learning outcomes, right? But secondly, I don't know. I mean, I think that getting students to loosen up and associate ideas with compelling narratives, or at least semi-compelling narratives, or at least plausibly compelling narratives, or at least not completely boring narratives, right, gets them better retention and better think-through than not doing so. So, you know, I made some offhanded comment to one of my students who took my sci-fi course about how, well, I bet that you remember more about empires and how they work than had I taught an empire unit in 06. And he was like, oh yeah, totally. And then he could tell me back about how empires were and how they worked. And I asked him about 06, which is our intro to IR course, and he couldn't recall any of it, right? So, I mean, I think in terms of acquisition of knowledge, there's an argument to be made that it's better. In terms of critical thinking and analytic writing, I think I would say I had much better outcomes in this course than I had in any of my other courses, precisely for some of the reasons that we talked about the nature of speculative fiction, but also because, you know, I took the analytic writing seriously, right? You know, the analytic writing was a core component of the course. They had to be writing all the time. And they had to be making arguments, right? And if you want to teach people to make good arguments, it doesn't really make a difference whether they're writing about, you know, waltz, right, or branding theory, or the relative, you know, or whether or not, you know, Dune, you know, whether or not the Harkonnens were using good coin, right, doctrine, right? I mean, the meat is irrelevant, right, from that perspective. So I just don't challenge the premise, would say that the premise is wrong, probably wrong. But the crucial thing is that you have ideas in mind, even though you're not going to overdetermine what those ideas are, because the students are going to come up with a lot of the ideas. You have ideas in mind for specific kinds of concepts, themes, theories, philosophies that you want them to walk away from. And you have tremendous power to shape the course in ways that deals with.
And if you need ammunition, at least within a U.S. context, you can go over to the American Association of Colleges and Universities website and look for something that they call the LEAP Project, Liberal Education in America's Promise. It's a D.C. organization. And one of the things they do there is they lay out a set of rubrics for how one evaluates things like critical thinking, which are the great virtue of the LEAP rubrics. Besides the fact that since it comes with the stamp of approval of the American Association of Colleges and Universities, it's harder for deans, and I say this being an associate dean, to turn it down. It's like, oh yeah, so an external authority has actually said this is a legit thing. The great thing about those outcomes is they are all content neutral. They have nothing to do with specific bodies of factual knowledge. They have to do with cognitive operations. They have to do with analytical writing skills. They have to do with close reading, extracting arguments, and so on and so forth. And there are some very concrete ways in which you can say, no, this is what the outcome is. In some ways, and I don't know whether this is true across campuses, it's easier to do this if you've got a freshman seminar, a first-year seminar. You can kind of put it in that way, and you can say, oh, it's preparing them to do well in their upper-level classes, and so on and so forth. And then you say that, and the institutional research people say, oh, well, we'll track this, and they never do because they get busy doing other things, and then you can just keep using that line forever and ever, and then it works pretty well. When you do it as a capstone, the great thing about it is that they have to produce a capstone paper, and then you can say, hey, look at these really cool capstone papers. And because there isn't actually any way to meaningfully distinguish between the impact of one class and another on a student's total intellectual formation, even though people try, you can always say, oh, well, we had a share of that by doing this class. Okay, great. And then that should be enough to be able to go through. But I think a lot of the skepticism of that is again, this sort of weird bias that somehow it's more serious and more real to be thinking about Syria than it is to be thinking about the intervention dilemma that is posed in Ian Banks' novel Accession, where it's a question of whether the culture is going to go rewrite the affront's basic moral codes or not. And somehow, like, one of them is serious and one of them isn't. And I'm not actually sure that's the case, that one of them is serious. So the real premise is not one that anybody's actually expressing in those discussions, which makes it very difficult to actually respond to it. But I think AACNU is a great resource for these kinds of things. They say, no, we got learning outcomes.
Well, I actually think that's a sort of difficult argument and somewhat dangerous argument to make. I mean, it depends on who you're making it to. I mean, my way of putting that would not be, the intervention theory is much, I think, more concretely important, question intervention theory, than question intervention in Banks. I mean, right. I mean, there are no real lives in the line in Banks's book. There are real lives in the line. The question is it better to get them to think? Can you better get a productive discussion about the ethical implications of intervention by discussing Syria? Or can you do it by discussing Banks? And I don't think that there is a right or wrong answer to that question. I think it depends on the students and the teachers. But I have found I can get a better discussion about the ethics of intervention through Banks than I can get it if I say, let's talk about Syria, with the caveat that by the end of the class, it's pretty clear that everybody's really talking about Syria, but now they're doing it from perspectives they wouldn't expect themselves to have done coming in.
Right. Yeah, when I say seriousness wasn't what I meant. I meant that it's not the case that one of them is sort of has virtue by being real or being something we should really be discussing. Obviously, the implications are different. I mean, Robert Cover once pointed out that the difference between interpreting the Constitution and interpreting Hamlet is people don't tend to die depending on how you interpret Hamlet, but the interpretive process is very similar. Right.
Macbeth now.
In the back.
I think what both of you have just talked about made. Do you extend parallels and if you do whether the what the relative merits are and in terms of thinking of the moral dimensions in terms of interacting with alien others, comparing reading science fiction to, let's say, how we're looking at encounters of Native Americans and, let's say, European explorers, or maybe the Japanese and the Dutch initially, the initially mentioned. What parallels might there be between those cases and cases in science fiction in terms of thinking about alien arts and what the relative merits of teaching one of God as opposed to the other?
I guess I would say, at least for me, that I get distressed when discussions about these situations turn into factual discussions. For the same reason why I got really dismayed by my students not having a set of equipment to deal with the moral question. The facts present themselves as if they were self-evident, and they're not. And dealing with a world in which it's clear that the whole world is an imaginative construct shifts the discussion, I think, in very, very interesting, very intriguing kinds of ways. The best times I've had with doing this is when people will be, as Dan said, sort of talking about a real-world event through discussion of a fictional something. You know, nowadays when we do Ender's Game in my sci-fi class, students are often talking about the global war on terror. And it's interesting to watch them kind of grapple with that. And then some of them make this nice leap where they go, wait a minute. In Ender's Game, we're dealing with a world that Card imagined and debating it in those terms. When we deal with the global war on terror, maybe we're dealing with a world that was imagined by some other people and they're debating it on their terms, and maybe it's all kind of fictional in certain sorts of ways. Whoa, and then they have the shutdown moment. The brain stops working. It's like, oh, good, you're thinking now. Excellent. So sometimes I think you can provoke that kind of moment through it. I don't know. The facts are seductive.
But if I may interject real quickly, some of the imaginaries that, let's say, Europeans have of Native Americans, or let's say the Japanese and the Irish have of outsiders, could be so imaginative and maybe even false that they might as well be science fiction. So
right.
I'm not sure that the facts versus the fiction part plays much.
But that's exactly the point, David. So when one of the reasons why I have them start off with Stuart Hall's West and the Rest is to give them a vocabulary and kind of a conceptual map for thinking about these kinds of things as we're reading the science fiction. And so the West absolutely is an imaginary, and that allows them to see then when we go and we read Ender's Game, okay, what's the role of the imaginary here? And they can make those connections back and forth. And so I think it's the fact that students have to make the leap that is what's useful here. If we're talking about a real-world example, again, you have these arguments over facts, you have people coming in with their own political and ethical commitments, and so on and so forth. And trying to talk about that explicitly often doesn't take you very far. Whereas if you're talking about it in literature, and then students make the connections to real-world examples themselves, you have many more powerful opportunities there, I think.
I mean, the thing with so if you give them an account of, you know, a sort of fantastical account of, you know, what Japanese people are like or Chinese people are like from the 16th or 17th century or even the 18th or 19th, you know, my students at least are pretty savvy. They know that this is, you know, their reaction is, this is a fantastical account. I can obviously see through it. What's the big deal, right? If you give them Todorov's Discovery of America or Conquest of America and have them watch Avatar that day and begin with what kind of representation is Avatar, all of a sudden I find they have to confront those representations that they don't realize
are ridiculous or imaginary, right? It's the denaturalization process in the cognitive estrangement process that Henry started us out with and that we've talked about. So, and then you can move on to other imaginaries of encounters, both real and fictional, some of which in the way that those in the mimic speculative fiction, but also the way in which these things are naturalized in part by speculative fiction when they don't even realize it, right? And so I find it more productive because, you know, it's very easy for them to say, I'm not like those crazy people. I would never see the Japanese as, you know, having, you know, strange rituals or whatever. You know, I know that's racism, right? But it's different for them to say, wait a minute, you know, my belief in that aliens might have helped people build the pyramids, that's racism. Or my view that, you know, Native Americans were had a kind of Pocahontas-y nice relationship with nature and superior knowledge, which I thought was all enlightened, might be a kind of racism or you know, or sort of Occidentalism or something.
Yeah.
Is, I mean, that's to me a much more productive way to get them to get to much more pernicious contemporary representations.
And in, there's another just little, it's a book that Naeem Inayatullah recommended to me a while ago, which I've taught. It's a great little book called Western Views of Islam in the Middle Ages by a historian named R.W. Southern. And you want to talk about something that reads like science fiction, even though it's factual. The kinds of very systematically developed European imaginary, European Christian imaginary about the Islamic world is it's extraordinary. I mean, these are very well fleshed out. Southern refers to it as systematic ignorance, but there's a very systematic, very rigorous, very text-based version where they take things and they put them together in something that approximates a form of order, and then of course what's really dislocating for students is to do that and then throw up any of the recent national security strategy documents and have them go, wait a minute, hey, we're still doing exactly the same thing. So I think what we're all sort of saying is that part of the point here is to precisely destabilize that fact-fiction boundary and get people past trying to think in those terms so that then they can think more creatively and more productively about some of these questions of, well, I would almost say, to think more productively about the kinds of questions that the people in IR who originally used the label constructivist actually wanted us to think more about, but nobody actually does, for reasons that have a lot more to do with the disciplinary history of what happened to constructivism in IR than it does with what the initial critical impulse behind a lot of that stuff was. But that takes us into a whole different panel. In fact, that's a good segue into what we're now going to go do, which is the luncheon in which Nick Onuf is going to talk to us about a whole variety of things. But Fred, would you like the last word?
Yeah, it's really one word. And because we're in the Ionic room.
Yes.
And along those lines, something great to assign is Herodotus.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, the imaginary history that is pawned off or, you know, sold as here's, you know, this is what the peoples are like that the Persians conquered, and it's so fantastical that it's a good choice to make that happen.
And then to juxtapose it with Thucydides' supposedly more factual version of the same things, which is, of course, just as fictional, but in a different way, right? So I think we can get to the same sort of place. And I don't know if Thucydides would be comfortable thinking of himself as a science fiction author or that Herodotus would necessarily be comfortable thinking of that, but that's a whole other set of discussions. And I think on those notes, many of them, it's kind of a strange fugue, I think, of notes, we'll stop.
And that is indeed the end of the podcast, which was recorded on Friday, November 2nd, 2012, at the International Studies Association Northeast, or ISA Northeast Convention. It featured myself, Henry Farrell, Jennifer Lobosch, and Patrick Jackson. I hope that you will check in again with us soon. We have some other recordings from that conference that should be making it onto the podcast over the next week or so, including an interview with Nick Onuf. So long, folks. Bye-bye.